Today is July 18th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive, also on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5, New York on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday, with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are different. Tonight, WBAI is on a membership drive. Back to basics on computing hardware. If you're running a business and you have an immediate need for computing equipment or software, you make the necessary purchase at that moment in time. You don't wait for a sale. This is equally true if you need hardware or software to satisfy an immediate, real personal need. If you can wait for a special sale, you may ask, when is the next special? We all know about Black Friday and the few days before and after, which also includes Cyber Monday. There are special sales and varying degrees of discount when there are federal holidays that are part of a long 3-day weekend. The number of items that go on sale may not be as widespread as Black Friday, but if you're patient, there are items of value. There is some important advice you must take heed of. A great or fantastic, unbelievable item may have very little value if you really don't need to make the purchase. I know that when prices are at rock bottom, the temptation is enormous. I wonder how many blockbuster computer items you have purchased that are still sitting in the drawer or closet because you think you'll need it one day. Don't worry. The item that went on sale will cost less in 6 months when it's no longer on sale. There's another thing to remember. The item for sale is at net dollars, which means the actual gross dollars may go up to twice the net amount of real income. A prudent rule of thumb is to buy what you need today. For tomorrow, when it's needed, it'll cost less. Then there's the issue of buying merchandise from overseas. I just haven't had any consistent success buying from overseas merchants. This is especially true trying to purchase OEM replacement parts that are no longer available from the original manufacturer. The issue is when it involves parts such as batteries, power supplies, and anything that has related electrical values. The ratings are often bogus. Even a simple thing like a power line cord can be suspect. You think something as simple as this would be, well, label UL approved. In reality, they're not at all labeled as such. This is why many hardware manufacturers have had to do a recall on these AC cords. Then there's the issue of buying refurbished equipment. Buying refurb equipment directly from the manufacturer doesn't create any problems at all. If there is a real issue, the original manufacturer, as a rule, actually accept returns and provide you with an equivalent or greater value replacement. This is almost akin to buying a certified pre-owned car, that which is a fancy word for a used car, but the certification is a real multi-point certification from the car manufacturer. If it is from a used car dealer, you probably don't have that much confidence in the purchase. When you purchase used equipment from a dealer, it may have pulled equipment. Pulled equipment is hardware taken from another computer. The hardware itself could be a peripheral that is out of warranty or of marginal performance. You may ask under what circumstances I would purchase used equipment directly from another user. Well, I consider myself quite conversant and qualified to evaluate hardware, but as a rule for the average consumer, I would not recommend it unless you have someone who you trust to be knowledgeable to assist you in the purchase of such equipment. And what would I offer for the equipment? I would offer just salvage value. If it is a system unit I am looking to purchase, well, check the BIOS date. The date would be very close to the date of manufacture. Hard disk drives have a date normally notated in work week of the manufacturer year. Find out the CPU model. I use Passmark to identify the effective speed of the processor. Today, there are low-cost systems that I would certainly avoid, even though they're brand new. They are equipped with memory storage cards with a capacity of 32 gigabytes or 64 gigabytes. Experience has shown that the early models equipped with 32 gigabytes have virtually run out of storage with each upgraded release of Windows 10. These memory storage cards are soldered onto the motherboard, making any upgrade on your part very difficult. You need to be an expert to know how to desolder these cards without damaging the motherboard. To recap, buy what you need today. Don't worry about buying equipment for the future. And remember, that sale item of today will probably cost the same or even less 6 months from now. And if you don't need it, you don't need to pile the stuff into a drawer or closet so that you could say, someday I'm going to do something with it, or I have a special project. Buy it when you need it. Back to basics with a hard disk drive. A doctor can and does prescribe sound advice when treating a patient who has an addiction to smoking. The advice is to simply stop smoking. You can ask those who have since quit smoking how they stop, and the answers are quite varied. There is no set answer. The simplest answer is to go cold turkey. Very few have succeeded with this method. Then you can list all the different things that people have tried. We have been advising people that when they rid themselves of a system, they should make sure there is no personal data that can be retrieved from the unit before it is disposed. The military method is to run a DOD or Department of Defense program like DBAN, that's D-B-A-N, and this is readily available for a personal computer. But this is not a real practical solution in most cases. The process itself is quite lengthy, and the assumption is such a program is universally available for every computing platform. It's not. If the hardware system is no longer operable, meaning you can't boot up or turn on the machine, how would you gain access to the hard disk drive? Many years ago, we had an industrial magnetic bulk eraser at the radio station. Manually rotating the physical hard disk drive over the bulk eraser or a floppy diskette media over the bulk eraser a dozen times cleaned out any information. This unit was originally used to demagnetize 12-inch open reel tapes. I remember the first time I used this unit. The magnetic media was indeed clean of information, but I had forgotten to take off my wristwatch, and as a result, my wristwatch was, well, no longer usable. If the hard disk drive was enclosed in a system and not readily accessible, we just ran the bulk eraser a few times more, and if any information remained, it was not decipherable. Back then, when there was a Radio Shack, a consumer bulk eraser was available. I just ran the bulk eraser unit over the media while I was silently counting down 99 bottles of beer on the wall. Hey, I'm just kidding. I actually started counting down from 13. Why 13? Well, after counting down, it was close to 30 seconds. A personal bulk eraser can be purchased today, costing no more than $20. Just do a search in the browser or do a search in Amazon. Let's say this is a one-time use and you do not want to buy a one-time use unit. There are other ways of addressing the issue of removing traceable information from a device before disposal. A more practical and near foolproof method is to remove the hard disk drive from the system unit, and that's of course it's possible. Install the drive into an external drive case. These enclosures with a USB interface cost about $10. Download from the disk drive manufacturer the low-level format program for the model of hard disk drive. The low-level program will completely rewrite all the timing bits in the physical unit. You can then remove the physical drive and reuse the enclosure for other drives. If you choose to just leave the drive in the case itself, you have for yourself an extra external hard disk drive or an oversized and probably a very high-capacity USB flash drive. I actually use these recycled devices for backup. On a more practical basis for the average computer user, there are simpler things that you can do. The assumption is that you are not a person of interest to the government, in which you need to go to such extreme to wipe all traceable data. This is where the simple solutions will be more adequate for probably 99% of the population.
Do a factory reset to restore the original operating system or setup to the system, or destroy the contact points or pins on the equipment itself. If you do destroy the pins, special equipment is then needed to gain access to the magnetic media. This won't happen for the average user. My final comment on this subject is do not assume a recycle center will destroy any information on a system unit, cell phone, or tablet for you. And do not assume that if you donate the equipment to a charitable organization, they will not attempt to restore any information. It is not that they are dishonest, but some may try to reactivate an installed program because it's no longer available. Remember, do you know who has your personal data? Do you know who is using your personal data? Back to basics with an annual computer checkup. In life, when you go for your annual medical checkup, there are detailed reports with many numerical values. Similarly, with your computer system, you should have a detailed readout of the hardware details as well as the software installed with version numbers and serial IDs whenever there's a major change to the system. Let's call this doing your annual computer checkup. There are two utilities that I use for this purpose. The information from each is more than I need, and the information from both utilities do have some overlap, and this is not an issue for me. I just as soon have more data than not enough. There are two utilities available for download. The basic versions are free to download and use. The reports are not encumbered at all with bloat ads or information redirection steering you to some other process. The reports are straightforward. There is Belloc Advisor from Belloc.com providing comprehensive software status information, and there is HWinfo.com with comprehensive hardware information. The Belloc Advisor builds a detailed profile of your installed software and hardware, network inventory, any missing Microsoft fixes, antivirus status, security benchmarks, and displays the results in your web browser. All of your PC profile information is kept private on your PC and is not sent to any web server. Belloc is available with versions for Windows and on the Macintosh OS X, Linux, and Solaris operating systems. The license associated with this product allows for free personal use only. For me, the primary information of importance is a serial ID for Windows 10. Many of us have installed Windows 10 from an upgrade of Windows 7 or 8, and if it's necessary to reinstall Windows 10, you'll need to know the serial ID from the initial upgrade to install a clean version of Windows 10. Belloc Advisor would also advise you of what updates are missing from not only Windows, but also from other versions of installed software. HWinfo is available for system installation as well as there is a portable version, and if you happen to have multiple systems, you don't need to install it individually into each system. Unfortunately, it's only available for the Windows operating system. Ah, but I did find a workaround. They do have another product that can be used, and that is HWinfo for DOS. But first you'll have to download a version of the original DOS from allbootdisks.com. That's allbootdisk.com. From this, you create a version of DOS onto a USB drive, of which you can then do a computer boot up and run off of DOS with a version of DOS for HWinfo. HWinfo is freeware and free to distribute as is. HWinfo provides in-depth hardware information. From a quick summary overview into the depth of all hardware components, always up to date, providing the latest standards and technologies. This enables me to know if a fan is working properly without opening up the hardware. For most notebooks, this is not an easy chore. There's also real-time system monitoring with information on accurate monitoring of all system components for actual status and failure prediction. You can customize the interface with a variety of options. A primary feature for me is the status of wear on the battery of a notebook. Over time, the wear factor of a lithium battery will degrade. As it degrades, the available uptime on the battery decreases. For me, the red line is when the wear factor exceeds 25%. This means it's time to get a replacement battery if I need to do any traveling. So, think about it. You need to have a computer checkup whenever there are major changes in hardware and software, as well as just to have a periodic checkup to make sure everything is up to date.
In the business environment, backups are performed religiously each business day. The information is retained for a specific period of time to meet regulatory requirements. For many companies, the end-of-week backups are sent to another physical site in case of a major disruption. This was the case with 9/11, in which financial institutions were able to get back into operation within a few days. For the average computer user, the only absolute data considered critical that needs to be regularly backed up are legal, health, and academic work that is necessary for a degree. The hard truth is that your digital photographic collection, music library, and collection of video clippings are important only to you. But when the time comes when you pass through to another world, I hate to say this, but the material will probably be tossed. If these materials were backed up whenever there is new material, it'd be nice, but it would only be the end of the world only to you if the data was lost. The Personal Computer Show is informational and educational, and we purposely do not try to inject editorial comments in other areas. But as it relates to backup, I should not take it for granted that everyone knows what is involved with backup. To ensure full integrity of backup for recovery and restoration, the process is more time-consuming than it is complex. But if you don't do any backup and the computer is just for browsing, okay, that's fine, backup's not necessary. But if you just back up on a regular basis onto the same external media and not keep retention of any data, in other words, you just write over itself, is this the ideal way to back up? No, but it's the least you could do. For most people, the critical personal data can easily fit onto a USB flash drive. If you don't know what to back up, just copy your user subdirectory onto the flash drive. If you do use a USB flash drive for external media, I suggest you download and run the program Speedout version 0.5. Do you know how fast the read and write speed of that USB flash drive you're using? Unfortunately, there are no speed markings on any USB flash drive you buy. This is a portable app program that will identify the read speed and the write speed of the drive. Try to use a USB flash drive with a high write speed. This will speed up your backup. The speed of read is only a factor when you need to use it for data recovery, which is, hopefully, well, never or rare. Consider using one different USB flash drive for each day of the week. If you do maintain retention cycle of data on a regular basis, give yourself a grade C. Let's say you also have selected data to be retained at a separate physical site. Give yourself a grade of B. Well, you may ask, what then qualifies for a grade of A? Well, if you back up regularly, maintain retention cycle of saves, and you arrange to have a separate physical storage of data, what's missing? If you have made arrangements for use of equipment in case of loss of hardware, or you have another system readily available, then you have thought through what backup entails. Let's say you're writing your doctorate thesis or you're filling your tax return on the evening of the deadline date. You need to also make sure that there's a viable alternative to continue processing in case of your system fails. Let's say you're using a cloud backup service, Google, Amazon, and there are other big-time service centers or cloud centers, and they're available and they're very modest in cost. Well, I got news for you. It's just the nature of operating hardware and communication system. They do go down. The process of backup includes, get this now, the process of backup includes recovery, reinstallation, and alternative processing when needed. If you're running a small business or doing independent consulting work, you need to have a grade A backup plan. I can tell you based on experience, most people think the loss of data only happens to other people. However, when fate has designated you as the lucky one to lose critical data, I then have a converted listener. This is like a smoker who thinks that they will not be inflicted with cancer until it happens.
Unfortunately, there are those who have lost important data and figure lightning won't strike twice with the same person. It can, and it has happened. In the past, loss of data was primarily caused by hardware and software issues. Now throw onto the mix of things that can cause a problem that requires recovery is when you got these hackers hitting you with social engineering and ransomware. Let's say you did all the right things and there was no mischief with your system, and your system crashed. Well, I'll accept the fact that it might have been God's will, but that still does not excuse you from not backing up your system on a regular basis. So get to it. Back up your system. Listening to the Personal Computer Show on radio. Let's start with what is traditional radio, or as it's now called, terrestrial radio. With a traditional radio, radio waves emanate from a transmitter, and the signal can only be heard by the population within the radius of the transmission point. An example of this is the transmission of the broadcast from the Empire State Building, which has a coverage radius of up to 90 miles. Listeners outside of the coverage cannot receive this signal, and the Personal Computer Show can be heard on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, in this manner. With internet radio being available online, listeners can access content from virtually anywhere in the world. The market is anywhere as long as the listener has internet connection. Because the geographical broadcast reach is limitless, internet radio programming provides content that serves a worldwide listening audience community of listeners. Optimally, an internet radio station should have a wide variety of non-localized content, making it tough for a listener to pinpoint a city where the station is actually broadcasting from. The Personal Computer Show can be heard on the Progressive Radio Network in this manner. Internet radio was created in 1993 and is defined as an audio service transmitted via the internet. Broadcasting on the internet is usually referred to as webcasting. The rise in popularity of internet radio has a lot to do with the wide variety of programming. How do you get internet radio? Well, you can access internet radio stations on a smartphone, your tablet, or a personal computer with internet access. You can also dial an assigned telephone number to receive a radio program. And there are also available internet radio plays that functions like a typical radio. Many local radio stations maintain an internet website and have made it possible to live stream the broadcast program on the internet. People are now just as likely to live stream radio stations via their preferred internet platform. Many stations archive their broadcast programs and make it available as podcast programs to be downloaded by the listener. Then there are RSS readers app, so you can subscribe to sites and have new content automatically pushed to you instead of you having being required to check the website to download the broadcast. RSS stands for Really Simple Simplification. During the holiday, I purchased the Amazon Echo Dot, which was the number one selling Amazon device this holiday season, and the best-selling product from any manufacturer in any category across all of Amazon with millions sold. The Echo Dot is similar to the Google Home Mini. They were each available for $30. Echo Dot is a brand of smart speakers developed by Amazon.com. The devices connect to the voice-controlled intelligent personal assistant service Alexa, which responds to the name Alexa. Alexa Echo Dot is a 360-degree speaker that uses a far-field voice recognition. The Echo Dot is always listening to its wake word, Alexa. Say it, and the dot will light up and listen to your question or command. You wake her up by saying her name or by saying one of two other wake-up words. Some of the features I've tested. Make telephone calls. This calling feature allows anyone who has your phone number to call you through the Echo. Currently, there's no way to block, remove, or silence individual contacts. Alexa can also be used to make calls to other Alexa devices in other houses. It can control your lights, door locks, appliances, switches, and other smart home devices. The recipe for chocolate chip cookies was the most requested recipe this holiday season. Keep Alexa in the kitchen to do things like get conversions. Alexa, how many tablespoons in a quarter cup?
1 quarter cups is 4 tablespoons.
You can ask for recipes or play some smooth jazz because you want to hear music while you're cooking. Get the news to let you know what's happening in the world. This is called your flash briefing, and it can be customized to include the news source you want to hear from. Alexa, flash briefing from Reuters.
From Reuters TV. From Reuters TV, here are today's top stories.
The unrest in Iran escalates as demonstrations rage for a fifth day.
One in five Americans can now legally buy weed.
Brazilians pray to the sea goddess for a prosperous 2018.
This is Reuters Now.
Iranian state TV showing buildings ablaze Monday as protests in Iran stretched into their fifth day. More than a dozen people have been reportedly killed in what have become the biggest anti-government demonstrations to hit the nation in almost a decade. Iranian officials said a protester shot and killed a policeman during Monday's protests, the first reported fatality among security forces struggling to contain the unrest. This video posted on social media showing a group of protesters confronting a water cannon. Here, video shows large crowds of people taking to the streets of the capital, Tehran, where dumpsters and cars were set on fire. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani trying to downplay the violent demonstrations, which began on Thursday over economic hardships and alleged corruption, and have since spread across his country to 50 other towns and cities, leading to hundreds of arrests. He appeared on TV Sunday to call for calm, saying Iranians had the right to criticize authorities but must not cause unrest. On Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "The great Iranian people have been repressed for many years. Time for a change." Rouhani responded, saying Trump has no right to sympathize with Iran.
Alexa, stop. Get nutrition information. Alexa, how many calories in a banana?
There are varieties of bananas. For example, raw bananas contain 89 calories per 100 grams, 25 calories per ounce, and dehydrated bananas have 346 calories per 100 grams, 98 calories per ounce. A typical value is 346 calories per 100 grams, 98 calories per ounce, for example, for dehydrated bananas or banana powder.
That's giving me more than what I asked for. Control your TV. Alexa can control your TV almost entirely by voice. To do this, however, you will need a Logitech Harmony remote that comes with a Harmony hub. You can ask Alexa for a song of the day, and she'll play it for you. Finally, I tested the use of the Echo Dot as an internet radio player. It worked. As always in life, there are radio stations, and there are radio stations. If the radio station is available with over-the-air broadcast, you just have to ask for it by its call letter or its frequency. Alexa, play WBAI 99.5.
Getting my 99.5 FM from iHeartRadio.
Alexa, stop. If the radio station is only available on the internet, you then make the request by the phone name of the station. Alexa, play Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network from TuneIn.
As we've all seen, when it's unbridled, when people haven't done their shadow work, is just horrendous. It's horrendous.
But Alexa, stop. Instead of PRN.FM. The use of the home assistant such as the Echo Dot or the Google Home Mini makes for a very efficient and low-cost internet radio player to listen to the Personal Computer Show and your other favorite radio programs. An inconvenient truth about Linux as a personal computing system.
As a personal computer system, why hasn't Linux taken hold?
There's a couple of reasons, in my opinion, Hank. One of them, and perhaps the biggest, is when you say Linux, you're really referring only to the kernel. The piece developed by Linus Torvalds, which has been adopted by I don't know how many hundreds of different developers and systems. If I said to you, I'm using Linux, your first question to me would be, which Linux? There are hundreds of what are called distros or distributions, which are very different and have different capabilities. Somebody buys a computer with a system in it, they want to be able to use it day one. And with Linux, that's not always possible. The tools are different. The applications that are available in it are different. The front end is different, so it looks different. It's not practical to say, I want Linux. You have to say, I want Debian, or I want another distro. And then you have to, once you have it, you have to see if there are sufficient programs to support it for you and sufficient tools.
Many of us have had orphan systems that just sit idle. We call it a doorstop. By orphan systems, I mean machines that are too slow to run Windows 10 or even Windows 7. They may be leftovers from XP days. They are still functional. You would like to donate it or give it to someone who can appreciate access to a working computer. Linux as an operating system works very well with legacy hardware. So why isn't Linux having greater popularity in the installed base of computer systems? No one really has an accurate number of installed systems, but based on web access, the following represents active online operating systems in use. The biggest one is Android. Over 40% of operating systems on the web is Android. Windows is a close second with 36.5% of systems. iOS is about 13%. Mac OS X is about 5.5%. And Linux is 0.66%. That's very, very low. Linux has been available since 1992. If you heard anything at all about Linux, you've probably heard about Linux distributions, often shortened and called Linux distros. When deciding to use Linux as a desktop computer, you first need to choose a distro. Linux works differently. The Linux operating system isn't produced by a single organization. Different organizations and people work on different parts of it. There's a Linux kernel, the core of the operating system. The GNU shell utilities, which are the terminal interface and many of the commands you use. The X server, which produces a graphical desktop. The desktop environment, which runs on the X server to provide a graphical desktop. And many more other system services, graphical programs, and terminal commands, which are developed independently from each other. They are all open source software distributed in source code form. If you wanted to, you could get the source code for the Linux kernel, GNU shell utilities, Xorg, Xserver, and every other program on the Linux system. Assemble them yourself. However, compiling the software would take a lot of time, not to mention the work involved with making all the different programs work properly together. So, when you want to install new software or update for new versions of a software with important security updates, your Linux distribution provides them in pre-compiled package form. These packages are fast, easy to install, and saving you from doing the hard work yourself. Many also use different package managers, configuration utilities, and other software. Some distributions are bleeding edge and won't receive support for very long. Others, such as Ubuntu LTS or Red Hat Enterprise Linux, are designed to be stable distributions that will be supported with security updates and bug fixes for many years. Some Linux distributions are intended for desktop computers, and some are for servers without a graphical interface, and others for special applications. But as most Linux desktop users will eventually discover, there comes a time when you just need to run a particular piece of Windows software on your Linux PC. There are quite a few ways to do so, and here's what you need to know. Linux is a free operating system. You can pick and choose what option you want. There are many variations to the graphical user interface. There are applications that will run on many different platforms. There are applications that are equivalent to what is available under Windows and Mac OS X. Most Linux distros will run on older equipment. You can even test run the distro before you install it on your hard disk drive or solid state drive. So, what is there not to like about it? Well, if you have a need for an application that is not available across different platforms, an example of this is a tax preparation program. Yes, you can do it online, but
That's for simple 1040EZ returns. Anything more than that, you need the application itself. If you have a 401k or other retirement plans, the simple 1040EZ return is insufficient. So we're told there's Wine, and you can use Wine on Linux. Wine is a way to run Windows software on Linux, but with no Windows operating system required. Well, Wine is open source. It's a Windows compatibility layer that can run Windows programs directly on your Linux desktop. Essentially, this open source project is attempting to re-implement enough of Windows from scratch that it can run all those Windows applications without actually needing Windows. But the downside is it won't run every application properly. You may encounter bugs or performance issues. More important is the necessity to install Wine first with each new release of the selected Linux distro. In a mass market product, one cannot assume that the general consumer knows enough to go through this technical machination each time there's a patch or there's a new release. I'm told that if you absolutely need Windows, then get a Windows machine. And that is why the adoption of Linux is only 0.66%. The number of Linux distribution is also declining. Exactly why the declining is taking place and how much it matters remains somewhat unclear. In fact, DistroWatch had at one time listed almost 800 distributions, and this was at its founding in 2001. Although less than 40% have ever been in active development at any given time. These tallies may not be complete, since some distribution probably never registered with DistroWatch, but they are pretty accurate as anyone is likely to offer, so now we're down to under 300 distros. So what's happening? Part of the reason for the decline may be that Linux is becoming less a hobby and more of a business strategy, where hobbyists may tinker, commercial businesses are more concerned with results, specifically in decreasing time to market and lowering development costs. With these concerns, businesses are less likely to experiment for experiment's sake and more likely to base their development on an existing concern. Perhaps Linux supporters are also aging and, like businesses, have become less time for hobbies and more concerned with immediate results. However, statistics about such a diverse group makes this possibility impossible to confirm. Another reason for the decline of Linux may be that the center of innovation has shifted in recent years from distribution to the desktop. Although most distributions have a default desktop, most of the major ones offer at least a dozen desktop environments, many of which encourage different work habits in users. Except for branding, wallpaper, and themes, it's usually easier these days to tell at a glance what desktop you're logged into than what distribution you're using, because of the almost universal tendency towards graphical package installation. You cannot even tell easily what package management system you are using, let alone the distribution. The odds are, however, that the technology you're using is Debian. At least part of the decline in distribution may be that Debian technology dominates. The number based upon Debian or its most popular derivatives, Ubuntu, has gone from 63% of the total number of distributions to now over 70%. This decline is so small that it may represent a statistical blip rather than a trend. At the very least, Debian derivatives are disappearing more slowly than any other distribution. Whatever the reasons for the decline in distros, it looks as though the frontier is starting to close. Some might say that the decline hardly matters. After all, the current 285 distribution is still more than even the most avid user can hope to try in their lifetime, unless they devote their lives to doing nothing else. Some might say that many of the distributions are so minor and so personal that few people even notice their loss. Their loss could even be a benefit because the fewer distributions mean more contributors to the surviving one. However, despite the disappearance of some promising distributions, few of those have disappeared and could be considered major. As minor distros have disappeared in the last 3 years, the top 10 for page views on DistroWatch has changed little, except to Ryzen 4 a position or two. Still, even if most of the losses have been minor, the trend is disturbing. Linux advocates have always prized diversity, and the loss of even a little diversity seems like a major cause of a concern. Even if it proves beneficial in some way, if nothing else, the trend suggests that Linux is straying from its roots
and perhaps becoming a lot less adventuresome and more stodgy. What, if anything, could or should be done about the trend is uncertain. It may be desirable to choose an operating system with your choice of graphical user interface and your choice of system components, but the average user is not willing to spend time building the operating system with each new update release. There are so many implementations of Linux with different user interface, each with their different navigation, that the average user has difficulty finding support. Just remember one thing.
People always clamor for, they want to be able to say they want it their way. I guess that's a reason why you have fast food where it only comes in one form and you get in line and you get your burger very quickly. But there are others that say, hey, I want my pasta cooked this way. What you're saying is there are not enough people to create a consumer mass to enable that to be a sustainable market.
Which, using your analogy, is why McDonald's is so big and some of the have-it-your-way places are much smaller.
Assuming that there is some de facto on Linux, my conclusion is that you don't have all the necessary applications that you might need on Linux. And my advice is pick the application you need, and then you find out what operating system it runs on. You don't say, I want an operating system, and what can I run on it?
I agree with you completely, Hank, but I think I'll go further and say the huge majority, maybe as high as 80-90%, people never do pick an operating system. They pick a machine, and they expect that machine to do everything that they want it to do, regardless of operating system.
Light-centric sensing plays an astonishingly major role in our cybernetic house, something not even I realized until I started rounding up all the places I know we'll use it, and to be honest, a fair number of ways I don't yet know exactly how we'll be using it. For example, we do ambient light sensing in more than 100 places, about a third of which are watching for leaks inside the ventilation ducts, about a third of which are ready to issue alerts if they see leaks in the roof. That's just visible light. Infrared light at its longer wavelength is essentially heat. And our grid-eye thermal mapping of the house is reading those wavelengths. So are the pyro sensors watching for heat at the stovetop. More light at a couple hundred places where we use optocouplers to interface from AC voltages to our control system. Electrical isolation of opto-isolator inputs versus their outputs happens because the inputs make LEDs turn on and the light from those LEDs makes the phototransistors turn on. There's no electrical path between them. We also have a motion-triggered passive infrared detector outside the front door. And the fans in the lavatories have those PIR, passive infrared detectors, built in. I'm putting a double pair of infrared gizmos at the apron of the driveway. These are beam break duets, one to shine and the other detecting that shine. So if anything comes between them and blocks the beam, ding, ding, ding. Well, not literally a ding, 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 but it does signal the control system. With a bit of separation between the two pair, setting up two beams to break, we also know which direction the beam breaker is going. That still leaves four toilet paper holders where I need to figure out exactly how to determine when the roll needs replacing, or more accurately, when to have a replacement roll on standby. Beam break might work between the arms that hold the roll if I can make the detection target small enough to keep diffused infrared from the very white roll of paper from confusing the sensor. That reflectivity can also be a challenge if I just want to look for a reflection from the side of the roll. A reflective sensor, many of which are called proximity sensors, also has optical challenges if placed at the wall behind the roll because it's seeing a cylindrical surface. Think about the geometry of a receding surface of a declining diameter as you go through the paper, versus the changing target size, that field of view of the fixed detection beam's sensitivity angle. I'm leaving out the most recent advanced usage of light as a sensor, measuring its time of flight. If I start a processor counting when an emitter sends out a very brief pulse of light and then stop it from counting when a photodetector sees a reflection of that pulse, well, here are some numbers. Light travels at about 30 centimeters per nanosecond. So a 1 gigahertz processor, meaning a clock cycle that's 1 nanosecond from tick to tick. Well, it can't measure anything shorter than a 30-centimeter round trip, or about 15 centimeters. Range limitations, both at the minimum and the maximum, that a particular sensor can read. Well, one of those frustrate the heck out of me. The perfect range seems forever elusive, and so far I'm just talking about a roll of paper. The smallest time-of-flight ranging sensor is the ST-Micro VL53L0X with a maximum range of about 1,200 millimeters. 50 millimeters is about as low as it can go. That's a good range for robotics or for gesture recognition or assisted autofocus. It's an amazing component for those, but a little bit iffy for my application. Adafruit has not an economical breakout board if you want to play with it. Again, that's the ST-Micro VL53L0X. ST-Micro, again, also has a sensor that's even better for us, the VL6180X, which can detect even closer objects down to 11 to 12 millimeters away, and which offers the ability to set a threshold. I might be able to make this one work. I'll need to do some prototyping and bench testing. If you want to do the same, Pololu offers it on an economical breakout board. Right now, ST Microelectronics seems to be doing more than the other chip makers with small sensors for measuring the time of flight of light. And if you'd like to learn about them, well, their website is ST.com. That has product specs, application notes, and so on. If you find one that looks interesting, search on its part number and you might find it on a Pololu or Adafruit breakout board. Pololu also offers a unique breakout board based on the Vishay TSSP77038 modulated infrared receiver. That's on one side of the board, and infrared LEDs on the other side, and that's triggered by a timer. So this is strictly a threshold device. Its low brightness version, for example, keeps its output pin low, turned on, whenever it sees its reflection on an object that's less, well, than about a foot away. This is using tuned reflected brightness at 38 kilohertz, not time of flight. Well, so much for toilet paper. Let's go to the garage. The garage has 3 separate parking spaces and 9-foot ceilings. I'd like to find one of these sensors with a 3-meter range so I can line them up on the ceiling at different distances in from the garage door. At each position, there are 3 things I can expect them to quote-unquote see. One is the floor of the garage, one is the top surface of a vehicle, or the third, the open garage door in its track. Short distance to the garage door, longer distance to the top of a vehicle, still longer to the floor of the garage. Now, I think it's kind of handy that a garage door in its track is in a perfect place to block the view of something shooting from overhead. And that can tell me a lot about where that garage door is, and with 5 sensors, which way it's going. It tells me whether the garage door is open or closed, of course, roughly how fully opened or closed. It also tells me whether there's a vehicle in that parking space below it, and roughly how far into that parking space. Initially, I thought I'd need to use the time of flight of sound waves, not light, but sound waves, specifically ultrasonic sound, in a technique, well, it's known as sonar in water, as sodar in air, or they'll call it echolocation in biological literature. It's a satisfactory technology, and I could still use it, but I literally don't like the look of it. There is apparently a whole other way of doing time-of-flight distance measurement at this range, because I see a broad variety of tools at places like Home Depot or Lowe's that use lasers and measure distance. At the moment, I'm nagging the heck out of those companies to try, not Home Depot or Lowe's, but the manufacturers, to try to get hooked up with their source for those modules. I want 15 of them, 5 per garage space, to look down from those selected points in the ceiling. I want another 3 with even longer range, maybe 20 to 30 meters, to mount on the inside back wall of each garage space, pointing out toward the door and beyond, which will let me measure the speed and position of any car that's entering or exiting, and also will let me know if a car has just been pulled into the driveway for something like, who knows, washing it? If that's the case, we'll want to keep that garage door from closing. The least expensive commercial LiDAR units that are capable of reading at that range cost around $120. I can buy 3 of those digital laser tape measures for that and pluck those modules out of it if it comes to that. The biggest demand for LiDAR sensing right now is from the automotive sector, most of which is dealing with zonal sensing, not point or line sensing, which is my interest. There is a lesser but also consistent crescendo in demand from companies making or deploying drones. There's one feature you may have in your own car if you want to look into it. Take a look and see whether it's using ultrasonics, radar, or LiDAR to detect obstacles when you want to back up, back up, back up. Well, stay tuned for Hank. He'll be with you faster than the sound of light.
Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeast region. Princeton PC Users Group has a presentation on social media for small business, Thursday, July the 26th. Meeting time, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on drones, sensors, and what are the applications for them. Thursday, July the 26th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society meets Tuesday, August the 7th, meeting time 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey is off for July and August, but they will reconvene in September, Friday, September the 7th, meeting time 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these club meetings are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there at one of these meetings. At these club meetings, there is a random access period in which you can ask questions. There's no such thing as a dumb computer question, so attend one of these if you have a problem and you haven't been able to get it solved. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI FM 99.5 in New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.